I don't know how many of you have seen this. It went around the internet, probably still is going around. I got this off of Facebook, which is where I get a lot of my best material. This is State-O. Maybe you played bingo, or you know somebody who's played bingo before. And the idea here is that every time you hear someone mention one of these arguments for an expanded state, you're supposed to put a little marker on that square, and if you get five in a row, then you win. Most days I could probably get that done in about an hour. Things like, some of you have heard this already this week. Bob Higgs yesterday spent some time on the one right below the star there. You know, if we get rid of the FDA, there will be rat poison in our medications. And, of course, the typical, if you don't like it, then all you have to do is to change it is vote, right? Getting rid of regulations will destroy the environment. I dealt with that one yesterday in my talk, and, of course, there's plenty of others. Who will build the roads? We just heard upstairs Walter Block. My wife is a teacher. She's familiar with the argument to the lower left there. You must hate education if you want to get rid of the DOE. So there's a lot of that kind of thing, and I'm the Department of Education. And let's just, without further ado, go straight into some of these, and you'll hear these. And I think it's important to be familiar with these arguments, and some of you, most of you are familiar with at least some of these, and you hear them on a regular basis. And I think we need to be able to address these common objections to markets and to capitalism. One of the more common and older arguments, of course, is the argument that capitalism exploits the poor. And you hear these stories about how during the Industrial Revolution we had small children crawling under running textile machinery to clean the lint out. And you've seen the pictures of these kids coated in coal dust that have just come out of some Welsh coal mine to fuel the fires of the Industrial Revolution and so forth. And of course, the standard of living at the time of the early Industrial Revolution was much lower than it is today. And we look at that with some horror. And I have had people tell me that if it were not for child labor regulations, parents would send their 9-year-olds off to work in coal mines today in the United States. I've had people seriously tell me that the only thing protecting our 9-year-olds from a life of pushing coal carts around in mines today is the fact that we have child labor regulations. And, of course, Mises deals with this in a book where you can find this online. I looked for it in the bookstore. I just had a few minutes to look. We may have it here in the Mises Institute bookstore, but it's a book called Economic Policy, Thoughts for Today and Tomorrow. It's a great little book. It's a selection of lectures that Mises did in Argentina in the 50s. But it's choice. A lot of the stuff in there I use today in my classes. Mises says, in answering the anti-capitalist, by the way, Mises also has another book here, which I'll mention later, called The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality, which you can find in the bookstore over here, which I also recommend. Mises says in the Economic Policy, you know that the population of this planet is now 10 times greater than it was in the ages preceding capitalism. You know that all men today enjoy a higher standard of living than your ancestors did before the age of capitalism. But how do you know that you are the one out of 10 who would have lived in the absence of capitalism? The mere fact that you are living today is proof that capitalism has succeeded, whether or not you consider your own life very valuable. Mises goes on to say that the objections to capitalism frequently came not from the poor, but from the very wealthy, the landed aristocracy in Britain. And he says the reason for this was that the landed aristocracy saw their labor force, disappearing into the cities to work in factories. So they realized, the landed aristocracy realized, they were going to have to pay higher wages to prevent these workers from migrating off to better working conditions, not ideal, not perfect working conditions. Certainly the factory labor had much worse conditions than we would see today. but better than they had on the farms, better wages, any risks that the workers took, the workers viewed as acceptable risk given the higher incomes they could earn. So the aristocracy said, well, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to fight this immigration, with an E, immigration off of our farms and land into the cities? And so the aristocracy, Mises says, attacked the industry, the factory labor, by criticizing the standard of living of the masses of workers. Mises says, the famous old story that the factories employed women and children, and that these women and children, before they were working in factories, had lived under satisfactory conditions, is one of the greatest falsehoods of history. He says, the mothers who worked in the factories had nothing to cook with. They did not leave their homes and their kitchens to go into the factories. They went into factories because they had no kitchens. And if they had a kitchen, they had no food to cook in those kitchens. And the children did not come from comfortable nurseries. They were starving and dying. And all the talk about the so-called unspeakable horror of early capitalism can be refuted by a single statistic. Precisely in the years in which British capitalism developed, precisely in the age called the Industrial Revolution in England, in the years from 1760 to 1830, precisely in those years the population of England doubled, which means that hundreds or thousands of children who would have died in preceding times survived and grew to be men and women. Not only this, we have evidence today of a vastly expanded standard of living of the very lowest income people in countries where capitalism has been allowed a relative degree of freedom, where markets have been allowed a relative degree of freedom. Matt Ridley, he's not an Austrian as far as I can tell, but in a book he wrote recently called The Rational Optimist, he says, you know, society is getting more and more prosperous, better place to live and so forth. And he says, today, of Americans officially designated as poor, 99% have electricity, running water, flush toilets, and a refrigerator. 95% have a television, 88% a telephone, 71% a car, and 70% air conditioning. Cornelius Vanderbilt had none of these. We have reached a point at which the very poorest in countries like the United States have reached a standard of living which the very wealthiest 100 years ago could not have conceived of. And of course, then we have to deal with this argument that capitalism is unjust because of the uneven wealth distribution, or perhaps some other idea of injustice. I'll mention in this book, The Anti-Capitalistic Mentality, Mises says that the fallacy here is assuming that nature is bountiful and nature has provided us with goods that collectively would not be scarce if it had not been for the wealthy few gathering or hoarding the majority of these things to themselves and leaving the poor out in the cold. He addresses this argument that everybody, by nature of being a human being, has this inalienable claim to a certain fraction of the goods that are provided by nature. He says, the poor are needy only because unjust people have deprived them of their birthright, and so therefore it's the task of the state to remedy that unjust injustice and make sure that everybody has their fair share. He says, every part of that idea is false. He says, nature's not bountiful. Nature is stingy. It has restricted, he says, the supply of all things indispensable for the preservation of human life. And so if you really want to see success or prosperity, you have to use human ingenuity freed up in a market environment to provide those things which nature does not provide, to take those things that that we have, the raw materials we have in nature, and turn them into something that is more useful and allows us to enlarge our prosperity. So he says, laissez-faire capitalism is really the source of any prosperity we do have. For that, we need to make sure that our society is as free as possible. F.A. Hayek wrote that once the rise in the position of the lower classes gathers speed, catering to the rich ceases to be the main source of great gain and gives place to the efforts directed towards the needs of the masses. Those forces which at first make inequality self-accentuating thus later tend to diminish it. Now, some of the largest firms, the most successful and most profitable firms today, are firms that are not catering to the very wealthy. They're catering to people who are quite ordinary in their level of income and their standard of living, like Walmart, for example. You're not going to find somebody like Bill Gates shopping in Walmart. The people who own Walmart today, the legacy of the Walton family, have made piles of money, particularly by catering to the desires and the wishes of people whose incomes are middle class and lower. As far as this inequality issue, I have yet to have someone explain to me why inequality per se is an ethical problem. Of course, a lot of people complain about it. They seem to be more concerned with the size of the gap between the rich and the poor than with the level of both. I have yet to understand why the size of the gap is as important as the overall level of wealth. If you're in the bottom 10% of income earners in the United States, your average income would be around, I think if I recall the statistic correctly, about $8,000 per person. That is far, far higher than the per capita income for the bottom 10% in a low income country, in a country where there's less economic freedom. So it tends to work to the benefit of the poor to have more economic freedom and more markets. We do see increased inequality at first, and then later it seems that inequality tends to decrease. So if you're worried about this, it might be interesting to note what's actually happening. There is an increased specialization in international division of labor. You're competing more so now with people in other countries, in Vietnam and in India and England and Germany, than you would have 100 years ago. This allows for a kind of a superstar effect, where there are people who are able to sell their entrepreneurship capabilities or their management skills to a much, much larger audience, and allows for a much higher income for those superstars. We see increased immigration, which probably adds to inequality. And we tend to see other things, demographic factors, like the fact that today, more so than in the past, high-income earners tend to marry each other, which tends to concentrate income. But on the other hand, we see indications that inequality in many countries is decreasing. IQ score spreads between the low end and the high end are diminishing, not because the high end is having a lower IQ, but because the low end is increasing their IQ at a higher rate or faster rate. We also see other indications. For one example that Matt Ridley mentions in his book is that the gap in height, which is an indicator of nutrition and various other things, tends to be diminishing over time between the aristocratic class and everybody else. There's only about a 2-inch difference or less today. It used to be a couple hundred years ago about a 6-inch difference. So that has indicated some level of increasing equality during the period in which capitalism has been more prevalent. Then you have this other argument. One of the readings that I mentioned and is available to you through a link on the schedule, I think, under this talk, you'll see a few readings. One of them I mentioned is by someone named Cameron Mofeed in an article called Global Capitalism in Crisis. And he says, well, you know, all this Western wealth creation has led to depression and neuroses and anxiety, and we're wealthy, but we're not happy. And so some people have suggested that maybe what we need to do is come up with some kind of gross happiness index. Quite famously, the king of Bhutan a while back came up with this gross happiness index, I think he called it, and he said, well, you know, we're not very wealthy in Bhutan, but we're happy. Our happiness index is higher than in many other countries, which I suppose if you are the king of Bhutan, you have to find some kind of measure that makes you look a little bit better than other countries. But, of course, a lot of this is based on some misunderstandings, misimpressions of the connection between happiness and wealth. There was a study in 1974 that unfortunately contributed to a lot of this misunderstanding by Richard Easterlin, which has led to something called the Easterlin paradox. The idea here is that wealth, increasing wealth, doesn't make you happier. Maybe it resolves certain problems that you might have. If you have more wealth, you probably don't face starvation, but it doesn't really make you happier. There are two studies, at least, that came out in the last few years, which indicate that that's not the case. Matt Ridley points this out again in his book. He says rich people are happier than poor people, according to these studies. Rich countries have happier people than poor countries. People get happier as they get richer on pretty much any dimension you want to look at. Increasing wealth tends to make people happier. We do see celebrities sometimes that seem to have everything they could possibly want, and they're on antidepressants, and they commit suicide, and they exhibit other indications that they're not very happy. But on the other hand, how do you reconcile the fact that increasing wealth tends to allow people longer lives, healthier lives, gives them a better education typically? All of these things are correlated with higher levels of income. You have lower infant mortality rates. I mean, I would think that a lower probability that your child would die in infancy would tend to increase your happiness. A more varied and consistent diet. Instead of being able to eat fruit only when it is in season, you're able to eat fruit in high-income countries any day of the year that you want because of increased trade. You have easier communication with family and friends. I mean, if I take a long trip, I'm pretty much in just as good communication with my family back home as I would be if I were living next door. That's a benefit of wealth, and that makes me happy to be able to talk to my mom or my sister or somebody like that. It's really that's kind of nice, and it increases my level of happiness. We get to see new places, even if we can't actually travel there. We get to see pictures and movies and other things that indicate an increased ability to see the world. But Mofeed, in his article, is basically saying, well, if a free economy can't make us free of anxiety and depression and so forth, then it's a failure, and we have to replace it with intervention by the government or socialism or something. And what this does is, in addition to confusing the facts about how income correlates with happiness, it makes the perfect, which is a problem-free life, the enemy of the good, which is less starvation, more education, and so forth. A free economy is not sufficient to produce morality. It's not sufficient to produce happiness. But we know that in a free economy, people are going to do things that are distasteful and immoral and so forth, and many will still be unhappy. But we see a reduction in the level of unpleasant things happening to people in societies which are more free. All right, so what about this other argument, again from Mofeed here? He mentions this this term economism. He says, well, what capitalism is doing is is it's regarding human society as a primarily economic system where economic considerations alone are governing our decisions, and we have this increased discontentment because of the reduction of workers to simply a wage slave. People are compelled to regard themselves as some kind of machine or cog in a machine generating income for survival, and all the other things, the good things about life, are neglected and sacrificed in favor of the pursuit of the almighty dollar. Okay, well, this is a perversion of the term economic. Most of you have had enough economics training now to understand when we say economic, we don't mean just monetary. We're not even necessarily referring only to markets. Economic decisions can be made by an individual without connection to anybody else. Robinson Crusoe on a desert island makes economic decisions. I make an economic decision if I behave charitably towards someone else. You have to make an economic decision anytime you incur a cost or make a decision to choose one scarce good over some other scarce good. That is an economic decision. So it's really about how we use resources of many kinds to accomplish our goals. Now, our goals could be good, our goals could be bad in some kind of moral or ethical sense, but we still have to make economic decisions in the accomplishment of those goals. If my goal is to see my neighbor fed and clothed and housed, then I have to make an economic decision on how to do that. Do I provide my neighbor food and sacrifice something else? Do I provide my neighbor with clothing and sacrifice something else? Those are economic decisions. Even Mofid is making economic decisions every day. So there is no conflict between an economic decision and justice, love, compassion, sympathy, cooperation. Those things are not antithetical. They must go together, because any effort at accomplishing compassion, for example, must take place with these costs and benefits, this weighing of the two by individuals. And if you are concerned with behaving compassionately, feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and housing the homeless and so forth, access to material things helps you in that. I might have a motivation to feed my neighbor, but if I don't have the material wherewithal to do so, then my spiritual goal is compromised to some extent. Also, in a free economy, if you decide you want to reject modern conveniences and tools and reduce your consumption of things in order to pursue an ascetic life, you can do that. There's nothing about a free society that constrains people to pursue the iPods and the Kindles and other trappings of our modern civilization. There's almost a utopian idea. Well, not almost. There is a utopian idea in much of this anti-capitalistic thinking. Weinberg is another reading that I had listed there for you. Stephen Weinberg, and the article is called The Free Market Utopia. And he complains that what we've got in capitalistic thinking is some kind of utopian ideal. He says people shouldn't be motivated by unequal incomes. They shouldn't be motivated by the desire to earn more. He says instead people should be motivated by the reward of an unequal honor or title, maybe a reward of fame or reputation, maybe authority. Having some kind of non-monetary reward, he says, would encourage people to produce. Walter Block mentioned Star Trek. I'm not really a Trekkie or anything, but he mentioned in his talk earlier this morning that one of the Star Trek movies and illustrating one of his points. And if you watch any of these shows, they have this society where I think one of the more recent series, a TV series in that line, had a kind of a capitalist character who was clearly portrayed as a kind of a despicable person, money grubbing, interested only in how many units of currency he had in his cash register, and the other people on the spaceship were supposed to be motivated by higher things like the desire for learning about the unknown, and yet we noticed that only one person got to be the spaceship captain. So even there, there's a scarcity, and people will compete for those scarce things. Competition is not something that is limited to market economies. Weinberg says, for many Americans, the danger of tyranny lies not in the government, but in employers or insurance companies or health maintenance organizations from which we need government to protect us. To say that any worker is free to escape an oppressive employer by getting a different job is about as realistic as to say that any citizen is free to escape an oppressive government by immigrating. All right. Okay. So I have a little – I don't know where this is coming from. One need only point to the tens, if not hundreds of millions of people killed by war and political purges and genocides and state-induced famines in the last century, the political imprisonment of millions of people, the slave camps, the Kristallnacht, the police brutality, the siege warfare of economic sanctions against other countries and other horrors that are produced by governments. And you want to compare that to an HMO? You want to compare this to the fact that if you leave your employer, you might lose your health insurance? Really? Let's have some perspective on this. I recently had a dispute with my auto insurance company about a claim. It was a couple of 3 years ago. But I didn't worry that my insurance company was going to put me in jail or kill me or anything. I can switch insurance companies in less than an hour if I want to. I changed jobs a few years ago to take my current job at Wofford College. I found that a whole lot easier than leaving the country. So I'm not quite understanding this. Then we get this argument that capitalism kills people. And you may recognize this. I think that's a Ford Pinto, and any common business ethics class is going to talk about how horrible Ford Motor Company was to build a car that was subject to such damage during an accident. And they say, well, you know, Ford made this economic calculation about how likely it was that the car would get into an accident, how likely it was that the gas tank would burst into flames and so forth. And we did have some very tragic accidents, which I'm not trying to minimize, involving cars like this. Some girls killed on a Midwestern highway in a Pinto that had been rear-ended. This kind of accident certainly is something we would want to avoid, and I'm not trying to say that in a free market system this kind of thing would never happen, and I'm not trying to say that in a free market system this kind of thing would be excusable in any other sense except that you have to make trade-offs between safety, the affordability of a car, capacity of the car, fuel economy, comfort, acceleration and handling, all of these other things that you have to decide what you want. Now, most of us do not drive around in armored personnel carriers that cost $300,000 because, of course, we say, well, you know, I'll sacrifice a little safety in order to get a lower price. And Ford recognized that many of their customers were lower-income customers were willing to take a hit to safety in order to have a car that was not $80,000 Mercedes or Volvo, and instead was something that they could use, they could afford. Certainly, affordable cars are preferable to mopeds, bicycles, and other things that are much more hazardous on the road, statistically speaking. Incidentally, a lot of government regulation induces people to purchase products that are less safe than they otherwise might be. We have only to think of the CAFE regulation, the corporate average fuel economy regulation that's been in place since the 70s, and various times the government has upped the miles per gallon requirement, says that any car sold in the United States has to meet a certain minimum gas mileage requirement. Well, what's the easiest way to get a car to get better gas mileage? Make it lighter. Less weight to move around. Less mass. Well, you could not drive it, sure. You could make a car that gets better mileage by reducing the weight of the car. Now, it's pretty hard to reduce the weight of the car without sacrificing some other things, notably safety. There have been some studies, the older Crandall and Graham study and some others that have indicated that we have suffered tens of thousands of lives lost every year because Americans are driving around in cars that are lighter than they otherwise would have chosen. So the regulation intended to correct for market deficiencies, supposedly, actually has made us worse off, less safe, and caused other problems. Okay, well, then there's this. Capitalism is aesthetically obnoxious and environmentally irresponsible. Well, I talked about a little bit of the environmental part yesterday in my afternoon talk. But then you get the complaints about urban sprawl, and it's terrible to see all these McDonald's and Burger Kings and gas stations and other things that have cropped up on what used to be farmland and so forth. I wrote an article for the Freeman some years ago on urban sprawl, addressing the argument of a colleague of mine who said, quote, "It's a bad idea to turn the whole future of a region over only to people with money to make." And he had taken some students on a trip down the coastal part of my state, South Carolina, and I think North Carolina, Virginia. And he had said, well, look, we've got all these kind of shabby-looking strip malls, and we've got parking lots and Burger Kings and other things, and that's unattractive. I prefer to look at rolling pastures and forests and mountains rather than look at a strip mall until I want what the strip mall has to offer, and then I'm pretty happy to see the strip mall. Many Americans have similar kinds of desires, and they like the aesthetics of untrammeled nature in many cases. One way to avoid excessive strip mall development, parking lots, and so forth would be for the government to stop subsidizing these things by providing the infrastructure at no marginal cost to the developers. You want to build a shopping mall or something, the government's going to fall all over itself to try to provide you with an extra highway exit and sewer lines and water lines and maybe even, as we've seen in recent Supreme Court cases, confiscate the land from somebody else to provide it to you so you can build your development. The idea being that the government can then collect higher taxes off of this development. So one step would be to get the government out of the land development business by discouraging the provision of these services subsidized by the other taxpayers to these firms. Another approach would be if you like untrammeled nature, buy it and keep it separate from development. Groups like the Nature Conservancy do this kind of thing. They'll get a gift from a donor, maybe an in-kind gift like a land donation or money. They'll go off and buy land or buy an easement, and they'll prevent people from developing the property. okay, well, that's one way to do it. And it's a way to do it without trampling on anybody's property rights. Mises says, only romantic prepossession can induce an observer to ignore the fact that more and more citizens of the capitalistic countries live in an environment which cannot be simply dismissed as ugly. Now, some of you are from some other countries where you will see things like this. The one on the left is from Uzbekistan, and the one on the right is from Kazakhstan. And I've been in Eastern Central Europe, and I've seen some of this kind of thing in the Czech Republic, some old Soviet era, and I've been in Poland and Slovakia and some other countries. Large urban areas are just stacked with these shoebox-style apartment buildings built in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s to house people at state expense. And my aesthetics might be different from your aesthetics. You might regard this as a wonderful, beautiful thing, but I rather suspect that I'm not all that different from you, and you might look at that and say, well, that's aesthetically obnoxious, and that was not the product of capitalism. All right, well, then we've got the BP oil spill. I won't spend a lot of time here because we've got some other things to get through here, but what about the fact that private firms often make a mess? Maybe not often, but at least sometimes make a mess. And sometimes it's a pretty big mess, like BP spilling however many million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico before they could stop up the little pipe at the bottom of the Gulf. We can't say that the accident was purely the result of some kind of profit-seeking enterprise on the part of BP at the expense of the environment and the expense of people who care about the environment. In fact, we see that intervention by the government into the oil drilling process encouraged BP to take greater risks than they otherwise would have taken. For one thing, they passed laws that gave the oil companies incentives to drill farther offshore, where there are higher technical requirements, greater risks. The cost of solving problems is clearly a lot greater in 5,000 feet of water where you can't send a human diver down than it is in 250 feet of water where you can. This is a map of about the time of the BP oil spill showing all the offshore rigs, and you'll notice that they kind of come to this abrupt stop at the Alabama-Florida border. Why is that? Could it be because Florida has restricted offshore drilling and therefore has pushed the oil companies to go drill where they're permitted to drill, which might be further offshore than they would if they could gain access to some of that Florida Gulf coast? So they've taken a larger risk because of that. We also see the period in the late 90s to the early 2000s, an increasing fraction of oil and gas extraction was taking place further offshore in water deeper than 600 feet. Only about 26% of crude oil extraction in the Gulf of Mexico was taking place in deep water in 1995, and then by 2003, it was a large majority, 69%, taking place in deep water. Why was that? Well, the government had established a scheme such that deep water oil drilling was taxed at a lower rate than shallow water oil drilling to entice the oil companies to make these larger investments. And so that tended to induce a higher risk. In addition, there was a cap on liability, something like $75 million of liability. Well, if you're only liable to $75 million and you can do $4 billion worth of damage, but you're only liable the first little bit, then it's going to reduce your incentive to guard against accidents and other problems. Okay, well, then we've got this, and you've heard this many, many times, the argument that there are corporate scandals. Capitalism doesn't work because, see, you've got WorldCom and Enron and various bank failures where banks didn't provide certain information to their customers, or they made investments that were clearly at odds with the interest of the stockholders or the bankers, the borrowers, or various other people involved. Cameron Mofeed, whom I mentioned earlier, says, well, there's a lot amiss with the Western capitalist model because of these corporate scandals. Now, there's nothing about capitalism that endorses unethical business practices. In fact, once we discover those scandals, what happens to the stock price of these firms? They tend to plummet, because once that information appears, people say, well, they were being dishonest with their accounting, or they were doing something else that was out of line with what we expected the firm to do, and so the firm will be quickly disciplined by the market in addition to whatever penalties might apply in courts. So people like Mofeed look at the same case and they say, well, we should have state intervention to promote various social goals. The market has failed. The state has to intervene. Well, that's what I call a non sequitur. You've heard that term before. It doesn't follow logically. It's like saying, well, your parents didn't feed you quite a balanced diet, and they yelled at you a few times, so you should be put in foster care. Well, again, it makes the perfect the enemy of the good. No market is going to be completely scandal-free, but it doesn't mean that we go to government intervention to solve the problem. Government intervention is not a perfect solution by any stretch of the imagination to these various scandals. In fact, if we look at the track record of the government at promoting social goals, we have a rather tragic track record. War and famine and genocide and corporate welfare and political scandal and bribery and corruption and police brutality and deadly regulation that we've talked about before. Yesterday, Bob Higgs explained the problem with FDA regulation, killing people because it denies people access to life-saving drugs, and more war and fascism and various other things. So it's, to use a trite expression, it's like the pot calling the kettle black here to complain that the private sector has problems with scandal. If you read Tom DiLorenzo's books on American economic history, you'll see his comments on the scandals surrounding the Transcontinental Railroad, the Republican Party shunting vast sums of money to these incredibly wasteful projects to build railroads in the 1860s and 70s. You can read Murray Rothbard on this as well. Tom DiLorenzo's got a great essay on the early development of transportation in the United States. I can't recall the title offhand, but if you email me, I'm sure I can find it. And he says the canal building episodes were just absolutely scandal-ridden because they were being subsidized by the government. We have Franklin Roosevelt during the Great Depression deftly adding about $4 billion to the government's books by confiscating gold at $20.67 an ounce and then turning around and saying, oh, well, it's now worth $35 an ounce. Okay, that seems like Enron-style accounting to me. Then there's the Social Security racket, which you're forced into. Unlike a private scam, like a Ponzi scheme, you don't have to participate. But Social Security is pretty difficult to get out of that, and it's had a longer life than most pyramid schemes that I've ever heard of because it is forced on everybody. Okay, then we have this argument that capitalism is racist and it's sexist. In a free society, people have the freedom of association. They can have whatever tastes and preferences they like. But if you engage in some kind of discrimination, you're going to suffer a cost because of this. If you ignore somebody's productivity level when you're choosing an employee, and you make your choice of employees based on something that's not relevant to productivity, then you're going to suffer because your competition that doesn't base its decisions on some irrelevant physical characteristic is going to end up out-competing you. You will go out of business, ultimately, if you do this. In contrast, government intervention can shield people from the economic consequences of exercising those kinds of preferences. For example, a price control on apartment buildings says, well, the price has to be lower than it would be in the market. Well, at a low price, you know, from your economics 201 or something, your first introductory micro class, you know that a price ceiling will create a shortage of the good, right? So the quantity demanded will be greater than the quantity supplied. So you have maybe three people that want the apartment for every apartment that's available. So the landlord now can pick and choose among three people. Well, I don't like you and I don't like you, but I like you. So the discrimination in that case doesn't cost the landlord the vacant apartment that otherwise he would have to deal with. If in market equilibrium, there's much more of a synchronization, I can't think of the right word, but equilibrium between the quantity demanded and the quantity supplied. You have about as many people looking for an apartment as you have apartments. We know that markets don't absolutely hit that equilibrium all the time, but discrimination would be much more difficult to pull off in that case without suffering the cost of a vacant apartment. Employers have an incentive to hire on the basis of ability. There's a couple of articles that I could suggest for you on this. One called The Enemies of Jim Crow by Jeff Jacoby, J-A-C-O-B-Y, and one by George Leaf called L-E-E-F, called The Economics and Politics of Discrimination. And Jacoby goes through the streetcar discrimination episodes in the during the Jim Crow era. And he says that the people who fought discrimination and segregation of streetcars were not the owners of the streetcar companies. In fact, in another study published in the Journal of Economic History by Jennifer Roback, she showed that in one southern city after another, private transit companies tried to scuttle segregation laws or simply ignored them. They wanted the customers. They didn't care what color you were. They just wanted the customers. In Jacksonville, Florida, an ordinance requiring black passengers to be segregated went unenforced from 1901 to 1905 when the state legislature then mandated segregation statewide. And that segregation law was passed over the objections of the streetcar companies. In fact, the hostility to segregation among those companies was so well known that when a group of black citizens challenged the law in court, their attorney said that he had to say, "I'm not in cahoots with the streetcar companies in Jacksonville." He had to actually make that claim because otherwise people would suspect that the private sector was supporting this case. There are a lot of problems with this kind of argument. Then I don't need to spend a lot of time on the bubbles and panics, the argument that capitalism is subject to these business cycle problems, because you know from earlier talks, for example, Professor Engelhardt's talk yesterday on business cycles gave an excellent explanation of how the government encourages bubbles and panics. It's one of the topics in which Austrians excel more so, or I shouldn't say excel more so, but have published more so than on other topics. And there's plenty of evidence there that government intervention, by suppressing interest rates below what they should be, bribes entrepreneurs, as Professor Engelhardt put it, bribes them into making investments that really don't make any sense. And those corrective episodes where markets tend to return back to a more sensible price and sensible interest rate are the recessions. And we would not have the need for those recessions, those corrective episodes, if it were not for the initial artificial suppression of those interest rates. Then we have this argument that capitalism won't pursue important projects. Well, there's the, you know, the high-profile stuff, the Hoover Dam and the space shuttle and various other things like this, the moon rockets to land people on the moon. First of all, we've got a calculation problem here. Decision about what's an important project. How do we know? Furthermore, any research that's done to land people on the moon or send little robot cars to drive around other planets or various other things, all of that technology, all of that research exists in the shadow of other research and other science that would have been done if the resources had not been absorbed into this government project. It's very spectacular to watch a government rocket take off, and maybe that's one of the reasons they do it. It's kind of a fireworks for everybody. We get to see all the entertainment value of this kind of thing. And I'm not suggesting that these various government projects haven't generated some kind of useful technology. They have, many of them. It would be disingenuous for me to suggest otherwise. However, we have to compare what we see as the scientific result of these projects with the unseen result of projects that could not be undertaken because the resources were pulled away from those places into what the government deemed a more important project. So yes, maybe we got, I don't know, Teflon or something out of the space program. So maybe we got Teflon earlier or something than we would have if the government had not absorbed those resources and pushed it into the space program. What would we have had? It's impossible to really know. But what would we have had if it had not been for the incredibly expensive endeavors that the government had engaged in? The space shuttle is a great example of this. I wrote a piece for Mises Daily last year, about a year ago, on the demise of the space shuttle program. And a lot of people said, oh, this is terrible. You know, the space shuttle was a symbol of American progress and ingenuity and so forth. Okay. No. It actually was far, far more expensive. Bill Anderson goes so far as to say, we have no evidence that the space program has created on its own any of the new technologies that make our material lives better. Instead, the program has utilized existing technologies. If you look at the estimates of what the space shuttle would cost per launch and what we actually got, they're widely varying. NASA had originally projected $7 million per launch. Because we're just going to, you know, land the thing, gas it up again, and send it back off. And it turned out to be something like, well, between $1.4 billion and $1.6 billion per launch. That's a little different. $7 million. And yesterday, one of the talks, that somebody said, well, if you say illion anything, people don't really know how to calculate that. Well, million and billion are 1,000 times different, just to remind you. Okay? All right. So we're lacking price information to give us an idea of what would be an appropriate effort. All right, last thing, very quickly. I don't have to say a lot on this because Walter Block has said a lot of it in his book, which we also have in the bookstore. I'm not being paid to do this. This is for free, Professor Block. but this is a book that'll give you some idea by taking on those hard cases that he mentioned in his talk this morning, on how to deal with the pornography, the prostitution, the drug dealing, the blackmailing, the other things that we see sometimes in markets that I would regard as immoral, and I think that, you know, pornography has a moral problem attached to it. That doesn't necessarily mean that just because there's a moral problem attached with an activity, that it should be illegal. Okay, there's a difference between those two things that's quite lost on a lot of people. So sin doesn't equal crime, as I sometimes try to remind people in my church. You don't have to, these two things don't have to be the same thing. Just because something is morally wrong doesn't mean you have to go make it illegal. Mises, and I'll close with this. Mises says, certainly there are people, many people who smoke too much and who smoke in spite of the fact that it would be better for them not to smoke. This raises a question which goes far beyond economic discussion. It shows what freedom really means. Certainly, this capitalistic system can be abused and is abused by some people. It is certainly possible to do things which ought not to be done. But a disapproving person always has a way to attempt to change the minds of his fellow citizens. He can try to persuade them, to convince them, but he may not try to force them by the use of power, of governmental police power. And I know that I have not allowed but maybe 2 or 3 minutes for questions, but I'll be happy to take any of those that we have time for left. Yes. SpaceX, yes.
I would just imagine someday in the future, like, people would ask our generation that, okay, let's say some alien come to the planet and they are far better than us in terms of, you know, that kind of movement and using this technology, and why we have given this technology the power of the government and all of these resources have been wasted.
Yes, and we look back at other episodes where the government has wasted resources, and we sometimes think, well, why – not often enough, but we often look back and say, why do we spend this money paying people to, you know, chase tumbleweeds or whatever it was during the New Deal? Why do we do this? It's just absolutely senseless to plow under crops in the Great Depression when people are hungry. It doesn't make any sense at all, and in retrospect, perhaps we can look back and we can say – maybe in 20 years people will regard the space shuttle as a joke. I don't know. Again, it's quite spectacular, but if the private sector can do something even more spectacular, not necessarily in an entertainment sense, but in real production, that's something to be considered. Other questions? Yes. There was a recent article, maybe some of you saw it, in the Wall Street Journal just last week or this week. Yes, saying that I had not read the article yet, but the author says basically that's not accurate. I know that Peter Klein on his blog has kept up with this some. You might check out what Dr. Klein has to say on that issue of the invention of the internet. Again, it may be that the government invented Teflon through the space program, or we may be able to find a few of those things. Did the government make as much of the internet that as the private sector could make of it? So even if we grant some kind of innovation that miraculously appeared out of the halls of bureaucracy, how do we know that innovation really made as much progress in improving our lives as would happen in an alternative world? I'm being signaled that I'm out of time, but thank you, and I'll be happy to talk to anybody afterwards.